podcast has been organized by the Low Residency MFA in Creative Writing Program at Dominican University of California, under the direction of Dr. Judy Halebski, in collaboration with the Communication and Media Studies Department and Penguin Radio.
Let me introduce our guest speaker. Molly McCulley Brown is the author of the essay collection, Places I've Taken My Body, which was published by Persia Books in 2020 and named one of Kirkus's top nonfiction titles of 2020. She's also the author of the collection, The Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded, from Persia Books, published in 2017, which won the 2016 Lexi Rudnitsky First Book Prize. With Susanna Nevinson, she is also the co-author of the poetry collection, The Field Between Us, which was published by Persia Books. Her work has appeared or is forthcoming in the Paris Review, the Virginia Quarterly Review, Best American Essays, The Guardian, The New York Times, and elsewhere. She is the recipient of a United States Artist Fellowship, a Sitila Raneri Foundation Fellowship, and the 2018-2019 Amy Lowell Poetry Traveling Scholarship. She is an assistant professor in English and creative nonfiction at Old Dominion University. And we're really thrilled to have Molly here with us. She'll present, and then we'll have some time for questions. And we are recording this session, and it will be publicly available in our MFA archive that you can find on Dominican Scholar. We'll post it in a few weeks after this session today. Great to have you with us. Please welcome Molly.
Thank you, Judy, for that lovely and kind introduction. It's such a pleasure to be here and to see some friends and familiar names in the audience. The Lexi Prize is an amazing thing, and the Lexi Sisterhood is really strong. Cynthia Hoffman, I see you in the audience. Thanks for hanging out and being here today. Cynthia is a beautiful poet who won the Lexi a handful of years before me. And if you don't know her work, you should go check it out right now because it's really brilliant. This kind of invitation I'm gonna tell you is sort of the best and the worst invitation to get as a writer, because it's one of those incredible invitations where people contact you and they just say, you can come talk about anything you want to talk about. And you think, oh, I am not as wise as you think that I am. And I don't have as many interesting things to say as you think that I do. But I was thinking a lot about the kind of talk and reading that I wanted to give today and what felt like it was going to be resonant in this moment and useful in this space. And I wanted to give a presentation that felt like it took into account the moment in which we find ourselves. And it also took into account that I'm speaking largely to a Zoom room full of other writers. And so I want to talk a little bit today about the ways that a project comes to be, about the ways that my own disability features and functions in my work, and about the ways that the medical past and history sort of rises up into our present moment. And I want to do that by reading a little bit from my first collection, The Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded, and then reading an essay from my collection, Places I've Taken My Body, that talks about the writing of that book. And even more than the writing of that book, talks about the things that I discovered about disability in America, my own relationship to disability, and the relationship between disability and the creative act over the course of writing that book. And so my first collection is called The Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. And I've been really lucky to talk about this book for years now in lots of spaces. And I have this spiel that I always give, which is that the thing you need to know is that the Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded was a real place that in the early and mid 1900s was one of the major hubs of the American eugenics movement. And what this means is that from about 1915 until about 1955, thousands and thousands of people who either had or were perceived to have a variety of physical and intellectual disabilities were forcibly committed and forcibly sterilized at this institution, not only without their consent, but often without their knowledge. They were told that they were being given appendectomies and then were sterilized instead. And that's usually where I end this spiel and start reading. But today, in this moment, in a year in which I think we've all been forced to confront the particular fragility of our bodies and the temporariness of health, I want to say a little bit more, which is that the Virginia State Colony is atypical in terms of these institutions where mass sterilizations happened, because up until last year, it remained a functioning residential facility for adults and teenagers with serious disabilities. And so the other thing that I want to say is that on April 2nd, 2020, 3 days after Virginia's governor issued a stay-at-home order, the last remaining resident at the Central Virginia Training Center, what was once the Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded, was transferred. And the facility officially ceased operations 109 years after opening. Because of the pandemic, her parents watched from their car outside the gate. She'd lived there most of her life. The transfer wasn't exactly a secret, but it happened earlier than planned. And like so much of the colony's history, under a weird kind of hush as the rest of the world attended to other things. And this 109-year chapter came to a close. That facility was only one example of the ways in which the really difficult and troubling medical history of America's past radiates into the present moment. The process of deinstitutionalization is incredibly complicated. The process of shutting down these facilities is incredibly complicated. But when I talk about the Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded, I am talking about a particular moment in our past, but I'm also talking about a version of our present and a legacy that will iterate into our future. And I just want to start today, before I switch to reading an essay, by reading the opening poem from this book, which I'll talk about a little later, and which is the only poem in the book that exists in the present moment. The Central Virginia Training Center, formerly the Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. Whatever it is, home or hospital, graveyard or asylum, government facility or great tract of land slowly seeding itself back to dust. Its church is a low-slung brick box with a single window, a white piece of plywood labeled chapel, and a locked door. Whatever it is, my mother and I ride along its red roads in February with the windows down. This place looks lived in. That one has stiff gray curtains in the window, a roof caving in. We see a small group moving in the channel between one building and the next, bowing in an absent wind. He is in a wheelchair. She is stumbling, pushing a pram from decades ago, coal black and wrong. There is no way it holds a baby. Behind them, a few more shuffling bodies in coats. I am my own kind of damaged there, looking out the right-hand window, spastic, palsied, and off balance, and taking crooked notes about this place. It is the land where he is buried, the place she spent her whole life, the room where they made it impossible for her to have children. It is the colony where he did not learn to read, but did paint every single slat of fence you see that shade of yellow. The place she didn't want to leave when she finally could, because she'd lived there 50 years and couldn't drive a car or remember the outside or trust anyone to touch her gently. And by some accident of luck or grace, some window less than half a century wide, it is my backyard, but not what happened to my body. Before I go on, I'm watching the chat and I love all of these comments. And so I wanna clarify that the last eugenic sterilization was noted in colony records for 1955. So the institution remained operational, but those sterilizations stopped at least officially in the 50s, although we see the legacy of eugenics iterating into our institutions and into this particular institution and into our medical system in all kinds of ways. And I should say also into our carceral system, into the prisons in this country, and into the ways that we think about what constitutes valuable personhood in this country as a whole. And I'm thinking here about issues of racism and police brutality. I'm thinking here about issues of immigration and the segregation and institutionalization of immigrants to this country. And I'm thinking here, of course, about our medical system. And so I want to go on now and read a little bit about the way this book came to be, and also the ways in which my understanding of disability and disability history changed in the process of writing it. Yes, and Indian reservations, as someone is saying, right? Any of these spaces in which we are sort of segregating and shutting away portions of the population and claiming that an other belongs only in a particular landscape and is responsible for the ills of the society. And as many of you who are writers know, our obsessions are often not things we choose, right? And our projects are often not things that we understand as projects when we begin them. And the things that mark and make our writing life sometimes begin as accidents, as jokes, as things we barely notice. And that's very much how this project began for me. And so this piece is called The Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. Growing up in the middle of nowhere means you spend a lot of time in the car. 10 miles to school or the grocery store, 35 to the movie theater or a decent restaurant, nearly 60 to the nearest place you might want to buy clothes. You drive the same stretch of rural highway so many thousands of times you stop seeing it. Mile markers and exit signs, the constant purple rise of the Blue Ridge in the distance, yawning in and out of fog. For years, I sped past Colony Road and the government-issued sign for the Central Virginia Training Center without much interest. I knew vaguely that it was a residential facility for people with serious disabilities, and that it had a complicated history, tangled up with Appalachia, eugenics, and the Great Depression. In high school, grappling with my own cerebral palsy, I sometimes thought about it glancingly, the way you consider something that almost relates to you, but doesn't, a distant relative you've only heard stories about. Mostly though, the facility was just another feature of the place I was raised. Red Clay Hills, Baptist Church, Bakery, Training Center. All of it unexceptional as my own hand. I was 18 the summer that changed, home in Virginia between my sophomore and junior years of college, taking a theology class at a university about an hour north of my hometown. Initially, I devised a day trip out to the boondocks of my childhood as a diversion for a close friend who was having a hard time. We bought cheeseburgers at McDonald's, put a dog in the truck, and turned the radio up. The plan was to do a drive-by tour of my one stoplight town and then continue on into Bedford, where we'd heard there was an attraction called Holy Land USA, a kind of homemade theme park featuring all the stations of the cross. The trip was supposed to be easy and amusing, a chance to share the idiosyncrasies of a landscape I loved. I don't remember now why we decided to turn off the highway at Colony Road. Because we'd never been there, because the honeysuckle was blooming over the gate and looked beautiful, because the dog was whining in the cab and needed to be let out. After the wrought iron gate, the road forked in two directions. One led to the facility, the other to a sprawling cemetery. Like many things in Central Virginia, the training center sits on a huge amount of land, the acreage around it much greater than you could practically ever use. As the facility fell into disrepair in the many years after its founding in the early 1900s, instead of being rehabbed or knocked down, older buildings were simply abandoned, new construction rising around them on all the available land. The day we first visited the place, it struck me as the eeriest combination of ghost town and functioning operation. At once, the establishment that it is now and the shadow of everything it had been, built up around its own troubling history in the most literal of senses. The training center today makes little explicit concession to that dark past when it was called the Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. There's a small sign out front that acknowledges the old name, and on the facility's website, a page marked history includes, just after a discussion of the colony's first post office, a single paragraph explaining that for a period, in accordance with Virginia law, the facility embarked on an ill-advised program of involuntary sterilization combined with routine appendectomies of so-called defectives with carcinogenic potentialities. That's all there is. No details about the men and women who once filled the infirmary beds or the salpingectomies and vasectomies performed without their consent or even their knowledge. That July, we drove slowly through the training center grounds, my wheelchair rattling like animal bones in the truck bed. The buildings were a mix of brick and white clapboard, the older ones slouching like ragged, hollow ghosts next to the center's contemporary facilities, marked with black numbers that no longer seemed to indicate any kind of order. We didn't talk much, but I hung half my body out of the passenger side window, looking at the whitewashed porches and the cloudy windows in which sometimes a stray curtain still hung, and counting the crossing for handicapped pedestrian signs. Occasionally we saw a maintenance truck, but whoever lived there seemed shut away inside. No one stopped to ask us who we were. Eventually we parked down by the cemetery and got out. I pulled my wheelchair from the truck, but quickly abandoned it. The wheels stuck in the gravel and the clay. I leaned on my friend's arm or put my palms to the dirt where the hills were high to keep my balance. We picked our way toward the outlying buildings and the flat grave markers lane into the hill. The stones were dated as early as 1911 and as late as the past few years. Some people had died in old age, but many more were young, 20s, 30s. On one section of the hillside, the graves belonged entirely to infants and children. A metal placard nearby read, "Dedicated to those whose lives and care we held in trust. As seedlings of God, we barely blossom on earth. We fully flower in heaven." I felt very aware of my own body then. My feet and ankles turning in underneath me, my contracting hamstrings and swollen knees, the steady pain radiating from my lower back into my toes. I remembered hearing about the doctor who told my parents when I was born in 1991 that I would probably never live independently, might never even speak. I felt time and space collapse. 65 years ago, born in my hometown, I might have lived and died in the colony, been buried in that field. I went home that day and Googled the training center under its old name. I read a little about Carrie Buck, the colony inmate who'd been the named plaintiff in Buck v. Bell, the 1927 Supreme Court case that upheld Virginia sterilization laws and made eugenic sterilization legal throughout the United States. Forced to undergo compulsory sterilization after she was committed to the colony while pregnant, Carrie was the perfect subject for testing the legal sturdiness of new sterilization statutes. She was declared the feeble-minded daughter of a feeble-minded mother, the first of three children with three different fathers. She and her family were the ideal lineage for eugenicists to cite when arguing that defectives would overrun the population with their mental, physical, and moral flaws if they weren't kept forcibly and permanently in check. when, in an 8-1 decision, the Supreme Court ruled it was in the state's interest to sterilize her, they legitimized the thousands and thousands of sterilizations that would follow at the colony and all over the country. And they underwrote the eugenicist philosophy on which Hitler would later base his law for the prevention of genetically diseased offspring. When Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., then an associate justice, delivered the court's famous ruling, he wrote, "Three generations of imbeciles are enough." Almost 20 years later, Nazi doctors at the Nuremberg trials would cite that language as a defense. The colony's history was a record of violence and discrimination that would radiate outward beyond national boundaries for generations to come. It also reverberated quietly inside my own life. As seminal a case as Buck v. Bell was, there's remarkably little information from the years in the 30s and 40s at the height of the colony's sterilization practices. Patient accounts are especially few and far between. In a regional newspaper story from the early 90s, a Virginia reporter describes tracking down a former colony patient who was released as a young woman and then spent her entire adult life trying to have children. Essentially, the reporter had to sit down at this woman's kitchen table, look at her in her wheelchair, and tell her her own story. This is what was done to you. This is the great shroud over your life, and you didn't even know about it. Reading it, I wondered how the woman's face had altered, then if shock or grief or anger had bloomed first. I wondered if there was some relief in having even an awful explanation. There's a list of operations in my own life that helped make me who I am, but I have a record of every time a surgeon cut me open. The names of things that doctors declared wrong with me, the parts of me they've altered. I've lived my whole life with these catalogs. What would it be like to lack them, or to have a stranger arrive one day at the home I'd made bearing all that knowledge? The virtual absence of patient accounts of colony life during the eugenics movement is undoubtedly the result of a variety of forces. The lack of information inmates were given about their own histories and medical records, the pervasive sense that defective people couldn't possibly have a meaningful perspective and experience worth attending to, a complex and fully realized inner life, and the amount of shame that surrounded being a former colony resident, even after inmates were released. All these things collided to produce a history characterized as much by absence and silence as anything else. Seeing the old pieces of the colony still standing there on the soil where I was raised, in the mountains I always recognized and claimed, even when the landscape of my own body felt foreign, tugged at me continually after my first visit to the grounds. But I wasn't ready to write about it immediately after passing through the gates. It would take me a few years to figure out how. And though I didn't know it then, it would require reckoning not just with my proximity to the colony and its history, but with the considerable space that shame and silence occupied in my own life. A year after finishing college, I was living in Texas and teaching creative writing part-time to inner-city elementary school students. At 21, I was an inexperienced teacher, and I struggled to control the kids in my classroom. Released from the bounds of their usual school day, they leapt after one another between the aisles of their desks, moving faster than I could travel into spaces where my wheelchair wouldn't fit. I felt unsuited for the job and, frankly, for life in the world. Most days, I came home in a lot of pain with my knees and ankles swollen. My body resisted everything I asked of it. I was tired and terrified and furious. My life was not going according to plan. Originally, I'd moved to Texas for graduate school, admitted straight out of undergrad to a prestigious writer's workshop. But I'd been unable to pass a required math class my senior year of college, or even a makeup course I'd taken online over the following summer. The same neurological damage that made my muscles spastic and my balance flawed also interrupted my ability to process numbers, space, and patterns. I'd gotten through high school math on a mix of hard work, charm, and the generosity of teachers who recognized my drive, but my workarounds had limits. I was too ashamed to admit the degree to which I struggled or to face the fact that I was flawed and damaged even beyond the boundaries of my body. I'd always been a gunner, foot on the gas, eyes on the horizon, ambitious about a future that promised to be better than whatever present I was in. I went to college at 16, and after 2 years, I left my tiny Massachusetts liberal arts school for a big California university and all the opportunities it held. My intellect, I'd taught myself early, was the one good part of me. Somewhere along the way, I developed the sense that if I did everything flawlessly and never stopped moving, I could outrun the truth of my body, leave it behind in the wake of all my excellence. But no matter where I was, my brain fired stray signals across the same flawed circuit. My tendons pulled too tight and my joints ached a little louder every year. I hurled myself from one city to another, one achievement to the next. But now the truth of my damage was intruding even on my mind. When just a few weeks into my first semester of grad school, I found out that even with tutoring, I hadn't done well enough on the final exam to pass the summer calculus course, I had to withdraw from my MFA program because I couldn't get a bachelor's degree immediately in hand. Eventually, I got documentation to confirm my disability's cognitive effects and petitioned my university to waive the math requirement for my BA. I found a teaching job, restructured my life, but I no longer felt like I had any idea who I was. All the ways in which I understood myself as smart, successful, useful had been decimated, and everything I did felt animated by some combination of shame and grief and rage. The familiarity of the hills and valleys where I was raised had always been a source of steadiness in my life. And I turned toward trying to write about the colony, partly out of a reflexive impulse to return to that landscape. But I was also casting around for something that mattered, a way to contribute, to understand and articulate the histories of brains and bodies like mine, a way to face myself as I truly was. I took a trip home to Virginia to drive again along the dusty gravel roads that threaded through the facility, to peer in the clouded windows of that locked low-slum training center chapel and look again at the tilted grid of grave markers covering the cemetery field. Back in Texas, I spent hours with the Image Archive on the American Eugenics Movement, poring over scans of letters from eugenicist doctors and articles with titles like The Burden of the Feeble-Minded and Freaks Are Bred to Get New Knowledge of Heredity. I saved copies of black and white photographs of people labeled with diagnoses, muscular atrophy, mania depressis, cretinism, spastic idiocy. My own contemporary diagnosis is spastic diplegia, and I saw a subtle echo of the way I hold my own taut body in the curl of the boy seated on the stairs. Eventually, I found a blank copy of the sterilization order they would have used at the Virginia State Colony, a form headed before the state hospital board with a set of options available to indicate whether an inmate was idiotic or an imbecile, feeble-minded or epileptic. In the beginning, I had no idea what kind of projects I was actually going to undertake. I'd done very little serious research before. But in the space left for an inmate's name on the sterilization order, I began to envision not just Carrie Buck's name, her mother Emma's, or her daughter Vivian, but countless others. Edith, Dorothy, Sarah, Addie, Mary Beth, Caroline, Molly. The more I learned, the less important and extraordinary my own individual pain seemed. Instead, the history from which my life extends came more sharply into focus. Much of the language I have for understanding my own body and brain is a permutation of vocabulary nurtured in the colony. So many of the reasons I've been running from myself stemmed from the same shame and fear, false equivalency, and internalized ableism that enabled eugenicist thinking. So much of the life I've been able to lead is evidence of how far we've come from the height of the colony's operations. So much of it is evidence of so far we still have to travel. The more I learned about the colony, the louder I began to hear a chorus of ghosts. The imagined voices of women in the colony, women who were epileptic, women who were brilliant, but whose bodies left them unable to move or speak, and so who were assumed to be witless. Women whose childhoods were stripped from them, who were never sent to school. Women with their faces pressed to dormitory windows, their heads bowed in the modest chapel. I came home from teaching and wrote for hours, sitting on the couch with my legs propped up on pillows to ease the swelling. I ate handfuls of dry cereal out of the box because I didn't want to pause to make dinner. I fell asleep with the light, with every light in my house still on, the computer open and glowing. In just a few months, I found I'd produced a claustrophobic little manuscript in the voices of these women, organized into the handful of rooms in which they would have lived, the ones I'd driven past and peered into while looping slow circles through the colony grounds. The poems were haunted, interior, and spare. I knew they couldn't stand in for the records of real patients' lives, but I hoped they might be an act of kinship, that they would call attention to the devastating fact of all the thoughts, feelings, and discoveries that are lost to us because they happened inside the heads of women who were committed behind colony walls, who were called feeble and idiot and insane, who were denied their right to be part of society, to have a stake in the future of the world. My own explicit presence in the manuscript remained only in a single opening poem, in which I narrated the trip through the training center's contemporary grounds and the circumstances that had brought me there. But the whole collection was shot through with my sense of how closely my body hewed to its history and landscape. I wanted my awareness that only an accident of time was responsible for the fact that I had written the poems in the book and not lived out one of the lives they detailed to open the door for the reader. And then I wanted to recede and let a history I'd once known almost nothing of take center stage. I wrote about the colony when I had no choice but to sit still and live with my body and my brain, when I could no longer run from the fact of who I was. For a long time, without realizing it, I conceived of my disability only as a lack and a strangeness, a thing that divided me from my family and friends and most of the world. I'd avoided considering its contours any more intently than I had to survive. I'd siphoned it off from the rest of me like a tributary feeding into some far off body of water. But the truth was, it tied me to a huge population of people who had lived before me, were living alongside me, and would come into the world once I had gone. And it emanated from this real shared heritage, made all the more devastating and complicated by the fact that so many colony patients were denied the opportunity to have their own biological children, were bound together by the violence done to their bodies. Here was the truth of it, after all. I needed to grow smaller in my own imagination in order to know myself, to do the kind of work that really mattered, in order to realize I'd never actually been going it alone. That essay, every time I read it, I feel like I think it's an essay about a different thing. Sometimes I think it's an essay about shame. Sometimes I think it's an essay about language. Sometimes I think it's an essay about the way our obsessions find us. Sometimes I think it's an essay about the complexities of diagnosis and the ways that we conceive of them. But I think it's always an essay about the ways that our lives as artists can teach us. And that as much ego is necessary when you decide that you are going to be a person who sits down at the page and puts their own thoughts into the world, there's also a kind of moving away from the self, a kind of devotion to a power that is larger than yourself, that teaches us things. And in just a minute, I want to take some questions, but in keeping with that feeling I don't want my own life and my own perspective to be the place that this reading ends. And so I want to close with just two poems from the Virginia State Colony. And these are in the Voices of Imagined Patients and Staff in the 1930s at the height of the sterilization movement. And this one is called Grand Mal Seizure. There's however it is you call, and there's whatever it is you're calling to. July, I sew my own dress from calico and lace. August, they take it off me in the colony, trade it in for a standard issue Virginia cotton. Not much room for my body in the heavy slip. Maybe that's the idea. For a while, the abandoning was rare, and then it was not and would never be again. Imagine you are an animal in your own throat. The dormitory has a pitched dark roof and a high porch. We are not allowed outside. Instead, we go to the window and make a game of racing dogwood blossoms knocked down by the wind. Choose your flower as it falls and see whose is the first to hit the clay. I beat the crippled girl every day for a week. The trick is to pick the smaller petals. Most nights they knot the bed sheet in my mouth so I will not bite my tongue. Lay out on the pine floor, rattle your own bones back to the center of the world. In the beds, the smell of kerosene and lye, the girls wake themselves one after another, spasm, whimper, whine. Outside, cicadas, in the distance, the big house lights. Another truck comes loud up the road, bearing another girl. There is whatever it is you're calling to. There is however it is you call. And I just want to end with a duo of really tiny poems that are the very last poems in the book. One of my favorite things about the world, and I think also one of the most difficult things about the world, is that no experience is ever only one thing. And so one of the things that happens in this book is that there are a couple of instances where there are poems that that are in pairs, and they seem as if they're going to be the same poem when they start, and then in fact they go in very different directions. So this is called After All, Nothing. One morning I wake up and the visions are bees pouring from my belly into the globes of my eyes. Someone hurls a shoe at me to stop my screaming. Otherwise, no one comes. I pass an hour like this. This is what no one tells you about suffering. Other people visit it upon you, and then you visit it upon yourself. After all, everything. This morning, I wake up and for a moment, I think the visions have vanished. Then I realize everything is shaded green. The visions have lit like Luna moths around the dormitory, on the doorframe, and the table, and the face of every sleeping girl. When I blow out my breath, they travel noiselessly into the air. I pass an hour like this. This is what no one tells you about suffering. Sometimes you would not give it up for all the world. Thank you. I'm really happy now to take questions about anything. I'm happy to take questions about writing and research. I'm happy to take questions about disability and history. I'm happy to take questions about graduate school, like whatever. I'm here. I feel like this is always the part where everyone feels awkward, but don't feel awkward. I'm happy to talk about literally whatever you'd like.
Molly, thank you so much. What an absolutely wonderful reading, and to hear your work. So compelling and inspiring, and you have such an insight into eugenics in recent history. So thank you so much. Yeah, let's have some questions. Maybe we can start with responses, questions, thoughts, anything. Abby, are you putting your hand up?
Yeah, if I can jump in.
Thank you so much, Molly. That was outstanding. And just one quick comment for the kind of clarity of the language and almost academic. I mean, there was something about the language and the syntax that I didn't expect to draw me in, but it was vividly, almost painfully hooking me right in. It was really this contrast, unexpected, beautiful contrast from the first sentence, especially that essay. So my question is, and I think about lobotomies all the time, not that that's what you're talking about, but for me personally, I am constantly haunted by the idea of lobotomies, and I have been for years, right? So I would love to know that I needed to grow smaller, you know, this idea, how that particular phrase, how do you work that in intellectually, literarily, you know, in any way, what does that mean? And how did you do it? And how do you use that in your writing, if you will, anything about it? Thank you, Molly.
Yeah, that's an awesome question. And thanks for that really kind response and that really great question. I think that for me, the idea of growing smaller has to do with approaching my writing life in a way that has to do with more than my own just individual personal experience, right? And that feels like a very paradoxical thing for me to say, as someone who just published what is essentially a memoir, however much time I spent being like, this is not a memoir, I'm not gonna write a memoir, that's not what's happening. I wrote a memoir. But I think one of the things that's so interesting to me about the personal essay as a form, right, as it departs from just straight memoir, is that it's interested in the ways in which our individual experience collides with a world outside of ourselves. Right? That is, that departs from our experience, that contrasts with it, that's interested in other things. And my favorite thing about being a writer is that I get to like learn a lot of shit about things all the time, right? And I feel like, and you get to know like a little bit about a lot of things, right? And I think that my writing is at its best, and more importantly, my thinking and my living and my teaching are at their best when I am interested in things beyond my own messed up deal, right? Like, we are very boring ultimately at a certain point, right? And also, we're better people when we are attuned to a world that does not stop at our own margins. And I think for me, that notion of growing smaller has to do with that sense of attunement, if that makes sense.
Totally makes sense. Fabulous. Thank you, Molly.
Yeah, thank you.
We have a question in the chat. Jordy, do you want me to read your question or do you want to ask it?
Oh, I'd be happy to ask it. I just wanted to get it out on paper as it
I know, Jordy. What's up? How's it going?
I'm Molly. Yeah. So I was thinking, I know you've bounced back and forth between verse and prose. And I just finished my PhD program, so I'm trying to get back into verse. After a long time, like, forgetting how line breaks work. And I was wondering how you returned, or if you've returned to poetry after Places I've Taken My Body. I forget when exactly In the Field Between Us came out, so.
Those books, that's a great question. Those books were roughly contemporary. And I am trying to sort of figure out how do I write a poem again? Also, really honestly, how do I write anything again? I feel like the thing about the year you put out a book is, and especially if you happened to, Judy and I were discussing this, be the unlikely person who put out a book in June of 2020, AKA the worst possible moment to release a book into the world. You just spend a lot of the next year like doing weird labor around the fact that you just put a book into the world, right? And so getting back into a place where, again, you are interested in something beyond yourself, right? And doing that kind of work, I think, is really tricky. But one thing that really helps me, and that I feel like especially helps me in relationship to writing poems, is just to become a person who lives with poetry again. So I'm like a big fan of printing poems out and sticking them up randomly around your house, not only your own, but other people's. The poet Natalie Shapiro says that a poem has two lives, one on the page and one in the air, which is a thing I've always really loved. And so I also try to be a person who listens to poems, like listens to poems. And I just try to remember that that I am happiest, and I'm also the best writer when I fill my life up with other people's beautiful language, right? And so I think coming back to poems for me means coming back to music, right? And it means coming back to this just deep attachment to the kind of ritual and repetition and presence of these small things. And so I think for me, the only thing that ever works to get me back into writing is to be a reader and a person who lives with words in sort of every way that that is humanly possible. I never have anything to say until I've listened to what other people are saying.
So if it's okay to ask a quick follow-up,
Yeah, totally.
Who are you reading right now?
Oh, man. Donica Kelly's new book, y'all, is like really just a stunner. You should all go find it right now. You should also go find her first book, Bestiary, which is brilliant. That book is amazing. I just finished Kirsten Valdez-Quade's incredible novel, The Five Wounds. Really super great Catholic novel for those of you in the room. It's extraordinary. And also just really beautiful on a sentence level, in addition to wonderful, wonderful on a plot-based level. And I'm currently in the middle of Jakira Diaz's memoir, Ordinary Girls, which is really great. And which I'm annoyed, but I have to keep putting it down to do boring moving in tasks, like attend to the person installing my internet. But instead I really want to be reading this beautiful memoir.
Great. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks, Jordy.
Other questions, other comments? Put comments in the chat or just wave. I might see you. I might. Hi, Lynn. We'll have Lynn and then David.
Lynn, I think you might be muted.
I can't, okay.
There you go.
So I'm wondering, being formally in the psychology field, how do you keep yourself positive and shored up? I think that's one of the hardest parts about writing, is touching into those deep crevasses and sort of going there repeatedly as a way of focusing your writing and fine-tuning it. So how do you keep yourself up and going and take care of yourself and all that stuff we have to do?
That's a really good question. And I think there are like tiny, boring, practical answers to that. And then I also think there are sort of the bigger answers. One is that in general, it feels easier to me to live with material that is hard or heavy or dark or complicated if I feel like the work I am doing is work that really matters, right? I feel like a sense of purpose is often what keeps sort of heaviness or sorrow or weight from turning into despair, right? Sorrow is not intrinsically a bad thing. It's part of being alive, right? And it's also part of what produces beauty and ecstasy and meaning. And I think that if I remind myself that this is a sorrow or a difficulty that is in service of something meaningful, that is helpful. Practically, and just sort of in tinier ways, I should always go outside more than I go outside. I feel like every time I go outside, I'm like, right, outside. That's a great thing. I think especially in this universe of Zoom that we're all inhabiting, I'm like, oh, wait, look at the sky. That's like a positive thing. And I also feel really lucky that my writing life is a life of community, right? And you all know the importance of that. You are all here in this virtual residency. You have intentionally chosen to make space for that community in your lives. The single thing that keeps me shored up, as you say, and I love that phrase, is the people and the artists that I love, right? And remembering that However much of writing is necessarily solitary is inherently singular, it's also a deeply communal act. And I mean that in the sort of sense of we're all undertaking this project together. And I also mean it in the sense of, you know, no work that I produce goes out into the world before people I love and admire have read it and told me what to fix. And that, you know, part of my favorite things about my writing life involve reading the work of other people I love and respect and admire while it's in progress and in process. And so those three things, and also remembering that I should sleep, I feel like are things that make it easier to stay shored up. But that's a good question, Lynn.
Thank you for the reminders.
Yeah, sleep and go outside. This is my general life advice, actually. Sleep and go outside and you'll be a happier human being. David, I feel like you had a question, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, like, first of all, I just wanted to say that I really loved your work and your presentation of your work. And you hooked me, like, immediately. It was like, okay, like, I'm skewered. And so anyways, that was cool. Are you familiar with Ian Curtis, singer of Joy Division?
Yeah, I was like, that name sounds familiar to me, and that's why. I am familiar with Joy Division, yes.
Yeah, so I guess what I want to say and kind of get your reaction is that, so, I mean, he had epilepsy and suffered terribly with depression. And, you know, it's like, tying into your work a little bit, if someone had said to this guy, look, you have epilepsy, you cannot be a musical performer, the world would have been so much more, you know, gray as a result, because he's so brilliant. He's influenced so many musicians and his lyrics are just incredibly powerful. And he would have, you know, like seizures while he was performing, you know, and it's just like, so like we use the term disability and or we could say there are differences and people have different challenges, you know, and he didn't let that stop him. And, you know, you were talking about your physical pain that you were dealing with when you were teaching and you kept doing it. You didn't let it stop you. And I don't know, the stuff you were talking about essentially the medical industry. And I wonder where was the Hippocratic Oath, you know? And how did you get people to rationalize this and follow through with these things that you were describing? You know, in effect, depriving the world of who knows what these people could have offered. And I'll just let you reply.
Yeah, David, I mean, I think you've brought up a host of really interesting things there, right? And in some ways, the thing that you're talking about, right, this notion of like, there is this artist, and in fact, there are all of these artists, right, who have disabilities, who suffer from mental illness, like all these kinds of things. And if we make the mistake of assuming that those kinds of things make you a less valuable person, we lose out on a huge amount, right? That is certainly true. It's one of the facets of the violence that the eugenics movement perpetrated in America. But I think it's really complicated, right? Because I also think there's a danger in the sort of erasure of disability as like a real lived reality, right? Like the truth is like, we don't all have some kind of disability. Some people are disabled. Some people are in chronic pain and others are not. Some people can walk and others can't. Like there are very real experiences that aren't sort of, they don't all blend into one, and we have to be careful, right, of platitudes that risk erasing either the particular lived realities of people or erasing the very real need for certain kinds of action, accommodation, and change in order to create access and create, David, the incredibly important thing you're talking about, right, which is the opportunity for these people to contribute to the world, right, and be a part of communities. And so that's a really complicated line to walk, right? It's a line that I think most well-meaning medical professionals are always trying to walk. It's a line that I find myself sort of always playing with as a person with a disability, and it moves, right? It's not a static border, and it's complicated. And this is an ongoing question, I think. And people with disabilities have have very strong opinions and not always the same opinions about how useful is the term disability to them. Do they prefer person first language, so saying person with disability, or do they prefer disabled person? Because many people, myself among them, understand being a disabled person as intrinsic to their identity, as constitutive of part of who they are, right? And so you don't want to say like, oh, I'm a person with a disability, the same way you might say, oh, I'm a person with a backpack, right? Because it's not the same thing. But these all get at issues of why language and talking about these things and interrogating the language with which we talk about them is so important. And that feels like so much of my project as a writer and so much of what I believe is really essential. So thanks for bringing all that up, because I think that's incredibly important stuff to have on the table.
Molly, thank you so much. We have, let's just take time for one more question, because I see Alyssa Fall is asking a question, and Abby and Lana are both saying they have the same question. So Alyssa, are you still with us? Do you want to ask your question or should I read it? I don't see it. Allison, do you want to ask this question in the chat? Oh, here it is. Alyssa's here. She'll read it. I'll let you read it. Okay. Alyssa writes, I love that you are in denial about writing a memoir with places I've taken my body. My question is this. Were there specific books, be it creative nonfiction or about craft, that were helpful to you as you were writing your book? And yeah, Allison's chiming in, what is your favorite or found to be the most useful craft book?
So I will say a couple of things in response to that. The first is that I will say that even as a prose writer, the most useful sort of discussions of craft that I have found are poets' discussions of craft. And I think that regardless of whether you consider yourself a poet or not, regardless of whether you write poetry, there is no substitute for the attention on the line level that comes from reading poetry and thinking like a poet about the fabric of the way you put your sentences together. People have mixed feelings about it, but I'm still a fan of Richard Hugo's The Triggering Town. I think it's a useful craft text. There's a really, Grey Wolf puts out a really beautiful series called The Art Of, they have involved a lot of really wonderful writers, including a bunch of poets, in writing essentially little tiny craft essays about the art of something. Mark Doty has one called The Art of Description that I think is totally phenomenal. The poet Carl Phillips has one called The Art of Daring, which I think is really also really beautiful. But it's really just a great series. And so you should all go find those. And I feel like different ones will speak to you at different moments and you'll need different things. Yeah, Ellen Bryan Voigt's The Art of Syntax is like a stunner. And again, syntax is a thing to be thinking about even if you are a prose writer. And maybe even especially if you are a prose writer, right? Because music is how we pace ourselves throughout those things. And then in terms of writers whose work meant a lot to me, there are tons of people. Natasha Trethewey and Jesmyn Ward both write really beautifully about their own life and also the ways that their own life coincides with and collides with history in ways that I think are really important and meaningful. The essayist Leslie Jameson, who writes a lot about the experience of femininity in the world and whose work I think walks the line between memoir and journalism in really beautiful and changing ways, is a really wonderful writer. The writer Sarah Manguso writes about illness in ways that were really important to me as I was working on Places I've Taken My Body. This list could be endless. Maybe I'll email Judy like a long list that she can give to you all, because I could do this for days and days. But I should let you all go.
Molly, this has been wonderful. Thank you. Yeah, if you do want to shoot me some recommended reading titles, I can share it with our students.
Totally, we can make that happen.
So thank you so much. This has been great. So for MFA students, we'll have a writing workshop with Molly Saturday morning. So we'll see her again.
We're gonna hang out. It's gonna be great.
So we'll be looking forward to that. At 5:30, I'm going to do an information session about the low-res MFA program. So if you are not here as a student but are interested in learning more about our program, you can come to that and we can chat then. So MFA students, we'll start at 9:30 tomorrow. And to our audience, please keep your eyes open for our upcoming events. It was wonderful to have Molly McCulley Brown here today. Fantastic event. And we hope to have more in this vein in the future. So please join us again. So thanks everyone for coming.